Welcome to Oncology Today, key presentations from the 2025 American Society of Hematology Annual Meeting, Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. This program is a follow-up to a live activity we conducted at the 67th Annual ASH Meeting held last December in Orlando. I met with Professor Constantine Tam from Monash University in Melbourne, Australia, who served as part of our faculty panel for that activity. I wanted to follow up with him regarding important data sets that emerged from ASH and his perspective on the impact on the care of patients with CLL. Before getting into the discussion of data presented at ASH, I first asked Dr. Tam to summarize his views on the current first-line treatment paradigm for CLL.
So at the moment, I think the default for CLL for a lot of countries is continuous BTKI, which is a huge advancement upon chemotherapy, right? You know, we all remember chemotherapy, and it really has changed the way we manage CLL to put patients on the tablet. They do well. They've got some side effects, but manageable. I think where the world is moving towards is some way of fixed duration therapy, because nobody likes continuous treatment. And there are two predominant ways to achieve a fixed duration treatment. There is the combination of obinutuzumab. And I think we're starting to realize that when you combine with obinutuzumab, that you have got three major problems. The first one is that you require an infusion, and there's the risk of infusion reactions. Secondly, increasing appreciation that it does increase the risk of infection death, especially in COVID era. And some will argue, okay, COVID is a once-off. But there will be a next COVID. There's respiratory viruses around, and we know patients on CD20 who experience prolonged respiratory viral infections. And the third problem with an antibody-containing regimen is that for patients with 17p deletion, they seem to do less well. Okay, so those are the things that we're trying to say. How can we achieve the same outcome of a fixed-duration therapy without the antibody? And that's where the oral doublets come in, right? So you add a BTKI and a BCL2. We know that they work pretty well, and the side effects are in general pretty tolerable, especially with the Acalavan and the Xanuvan combination. But the problem with those drugs is that the MRD clearance rate are not that great, right? So we've got MRD clearance rates of under 50% compared to, 70% with obinutuzumab containing regimens. Then the next step is, well, how do we make that better? How can we stick to the tablet format, two tablets, fixed duration, and yet still get high MRD clearance? And it looks like from the emerging data that the key to do that is to upgrade the BCL2. Switch out the venetoclax for better drug, such as sonrotoclax. At the same time, I think the other group of abstracts really looked at, what happens if we bring in better BTKIs into the front line, like pirtobrutinib. And to be perfectly honest with you, I'm not convinced by the pirtobrutinib frontline data. I think it is undoubtedly a better tolerated drug compared to ibrutinib, but I'm unconvinced that it actually is more effective than ibrutinib or zanubrutinib or Caligella in the frontline.
So I want to get into that in a second, but first, just to kind of go back to where we are today, and assuming you have the option of BTK venetoclax, so now you've avoided the infusion, you've avoided issues with obinutuzumab, but you still have issues related to venetoclax, although it doesn't really seem like it's that huge of a deal. That's what I wanted to ask you. So at least right now, in terms of where we kind of have data and a lot of the approvals, when you think about a BTK / venetoclax, whether it's a calivenetoclax or I guess at this point maybe a ibrutinib and in the future zanubrutinib, what kind of patient would you not want to give venetoclax to, or was it problematic to give venetoclax to?
Yep. So the biggest problem with venetoclax is tumor lysis syndrome, right? So that's the one that, and I think about tumor lysis syndrome in terms of two major themes. The first theme is obviously it's dangerous, but the reality is that when you use the combinations of either obinutuzumab or a BTKI plus venetoclax, tumor lysis actually doesn't really happen. Because by the time the patients start their venetoclax or their sonrotoclax, they're so well debulked that if we look across a clinical trial, the tumor lysis is always reported in a very low percentage, but on the ground, it really doesn't happen, especially with the monitoring practices that we're building. So the second aspect of tumor lysis syndrome is we all have to go through the ramp up with the monitoring, which nobody likes because, you know, it's cumbersome and takes up our time, takes up the patient's time. It's complex and it makes the regimen a lot harder to deliver than it should. So your question is, which patients are not suitable for venetoclax? The answer is actually very few. So patients who have got, let's say, very poor renal function, where if they get tumor lysis syndrome, you don't think that you can effectively treat them for the hyperkalemia. In a very rare event that happens, yes, maybe I will avoid venetoclax. But really, with the modern combination regimens, there are very few who can't get it.
I guess the only thing I would think about, I don't know how common it is where you are, maybe, or situations where it's very difficult for the patient to get to clinic, because it does seem like it's going to be more clinic visits. But other than that, it's hard to see very much. But I don't know, do you have a lot of patients who come in remotely from a couple hours away?
Correct. So I live in a very big country, okay, where, you know, we're very centralized and a lot of people live a long way away. So you bring me exactly to my second point. Which patients are not suitable is not the biology, it's the logistics. It's where they live.
Right.
And
right.
Whether they can actually come into the clinic for the real-time tumor lysis monitoring, because where they live, you can't get real-time labs, you can't trust someone to look after them. But, you know, that brings me to the next step, right? It's something to be overcome, because the reality is that we don't really see tumor lysis. We have to go through the monitoring. And I think what would be really helpful would be some way to address that problem. You know, can we develop regimens of either more gentle ramp-ups, which further decreases the risk of tumor lysis risk to nothing? Or are there better ways of monitoring this with new technologies? And I guess in my mind, I'm thinking about, let's say, like an oral contraceptive pill pack, where you start from day one and you go all the way to day 28, mm-hmm. and you have a gradual build-up with the drug each day to a point where maybe you've got such a gradual build-up that you just do not get tumor lysis and you do not require monitoring. Obviously, that's for the future, but I think at the moment it's the logistics of delivering the drug that is a barrier and not the biology of the patient.
One of the kind of themes I want to run by you as we go through this conversation is, I don't know, but I'm going to use the term myths and misperceptions that you might see in community-based physicians, things that you would do differently. In terms of venetoclax and monitoring for, you know, tumor lysis, you know, we come a long way because of the fact we realize these people are going to get debulked. Anything you see people doing, are people ramping up too fast? Are they doing anything? Has everybody kind of got the message about how you do this?
I think, at least in my area, most people have got used to the system of how it's done. I think a couple of important pointers is that venetoclax actually has a fairly long half-life. So if you ramp it up without giving the full, so the full 1 week between the doses, then it means that you probably haven't reached a steady state before you go step up to the next dose. And that's one advantage of sonrotoclax, is it's got a very short half-life, so it can ramp up faster. So I always, unless in extreme circumstances, I try not to dose escalate venetoclax faster than the once a week, which is what it's approved for. The second thing to appreciate is that the critical doses are probably the first 2 weeks, the 20 milligrams and 50 milligrams, which is usually where if you see tumor lysis, it will happen. And the critical time for tumor lysis is actually the 6 to 8 hour post-dose time point. So that's probably when you're going to see the tumor lysis happen. What that basically means is that at least for those two doses, you want to dose the patient nice and early in the morning at about 8 a.m. so that you can get a blood test by about 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. in the afternoon in order for the laboratory result to come back by the time you check out from work. So those are probably the key points.
It's interesting. Notice when you were talking about the study of pirtobrutinib versus BR, there was actually one death in the BR arm from tumor lysis syndrome,
yep.
Which I guess reminds us that we can see it also with the obinutuzumab. How often do you see tumor lysis there, and any caution you take in particularly people with higher bulk?
Yep. I actually do, excellent point. I actually do check tumor lysis bloods for obinutuzumab for the day one and day two, and also check a blood test on day three for patients with very high white cell count. Those are the same patients that you know about, because they're the ones who are most likely to get reactions and the ones that you pay very close attention to. And you're right, if you look at the CL14 study, which looked at, you know, venetoclax obinutuzumab versus clorambucil plus obinutuzumab, there was actually more tumor lysis on the clorambucil arm because of obinutuzumab. So ironically, the tumor lysis risk was lower on the venetoclax arm.
So you mentioned sonrotoclax and the fact that, quote, it's 10 times more potent. Could you kind of draw that out a little bit in terms of, you know, your vision without slides and how you describe it when you're making rounds, walking down the hall, about how these agents work and what the implications of greater activity you mentioned exists with sonrotoclax?
Yep. So sonrotoclax can be, it's basically just a really potent version of venetoclax. It binds BCL2 much more tightly. And one of the advantages, which we yet to prove, is that it might actually be active against the mutations that confer venetoclax resistance. So in particular for venetoclax, you can get a mutation in the BCL2 protein at the 101 position. And what it does is it makes BCL2 less sensitive to venetoclax. It doesn't make it resistant, it makes it less sensitive. So the whole idea is that if you come with a bigger hammer, like sonrotoclax, that you can actually inhibit those patients as well. And maybe when you go, if you hit someone with a bigger hammer, they will not get those resistance at all. So I think that's the main advantage of sonrotoclax. It's just a lot more potent. It's a bigger hammer. The other advantage is that it's got a shorter half-life, so you can ramp it up faster potentially, although at the moment it's still designed as a once-a-week ramp-up. And lastly, despite being a bigger hammer, in terms of the side effects, in terms of the diarrhea, the reflux, and the neutropenia that we see with venetoclax, it looks about the same or maybe even better. So we're not paying really a price for the improved efficacy.
Just out of curiosity, is sonrotoclax being looked at or has been looked at in other diseases, AML, myeloma, et cetera?
Yep. It's being looked at across the full range. So there's phase ones going on for myeloma, AML, as well as for mantle cell lymphoma and marginal zone lymphoma.
So maybe you could just capsulize a little bit about what you went through in your presentation in terms of the MRD results with sonrotoclax. And you know, it looked like MRD results were indirectly more impressive. Can you kind of summarize that and also where you see things heading in terms of MRD clinically, but also in terms of regulatory? You know, there was just this announcement from the FDA about MRD being a major endpoint in myeloma. Do you see that coming in CLL? And any comments about, again, MRD with sonrotoclax and where you see MRD heading in general in CLL?
Yep. So the available data would suggest that if you look at, if you improve the BCL2 from venetoclax to sonrotoclax in either the BDK plus BCL2 combination or basically the venetoclax obinutuzumab combination, that you've got an improvement in MRD. And I think it's really marked in the oral combination, where for the venetoclax combinations, it doesn't matter who you partner with for the BDK, you're hitting the MRD ceiling at around 50%. And yet when you give Zeno plus Somro, you've got MRD rates of above 90%. So I think that's really where the real signal that Somro is a better drug is coming from. Now, with the FDA approved MRD as a primary endpoint, just like myeloma, we would love the FDA to do that. They have, and I can't speak for the FDA, but so far they have been less amenable to using MRD as an endpoint in CLL. And I think MRD as an endpoint in CLL is a little bit troublesome because there are MRD assessments in the blood and there's MRD assessments in the bone marrow. Now, when you do not have any CD20 body on board, so if you just use an oral combination, the blood in general is a reliable assessment of MRD compared to bone marrow. They look very similar. But when you include either rituximab or obinutuzumab system in the mix, those drugs clear MRD faster in the blood compared to the bone marrow. So it means that when you're looking at the MRD data for, let's say, a obinutuzumab containing regimen compared to a regimen that is only oral, the MRD in the peripheral blood is probably overstated for the patients getting obinutuzumab because obinutuzumab preferentially clears MRD from the blood. And those patients still require bone marrow biopsies to get a true MRD state. And of course, nobody likes doing bone marrow in CLL.
Let's talk about, you know, the basic decisions in first-line therapy. And, of course, the biggest one, I think, is whether it's going to be time-limited or not. Maybe you can just talk a little bit in terms of what the CLL17 study looked at and found And generally right now, what we've learned, I mean, we've been going on this thought that time-limited therapy and single-agent continuous BTK were equivalent choices clinically for a while now. What evidence do we have that's the case right now?
Yep. So under CLL17 is the randomized proof of that, that general feeling that maybe time-limited and continuous is similar, right? Now, there's a couple of caveats. So CLL17 has three arms, one of which ibrutinib venetoclax is not really applicable to the US. So really, it's a comparison between continuous ibrutinib and venetoclax plus obinutuzumab. And then, of course, nobody uses ibrutinib anymore. So that data is already outdated. You know, second-generation drugs are probably going to be better tolerated and maybe more effective, depending on which one you look at. But ultimately, it's a comparison between BTKI and Van-O-Bin. And I think that at the data point, which is 3 years, that is probably a little bit too early to tell. You know, the curves are identical at the 3-year mark, but I don't really expect the difference to emerge until later, because we know that if you've got venetoclax obinutuzumab, you don't really relapse until about the 5-year mark, right? So you're probably going to see a separation of curve a bit later. And it would not surprise me with continued follow-up that at least the headline result for continuous BTKI would do better than venetoclax obinutuzumab, because you've got one patient who's continuing drug and the other patient who stopped and is waiting to relapse. The one thing that we need to understand, though, is that there's a nuance in the data, because the implications for progressing on the two arms are different. And this is where you need to think about the data a bit more deeply. If you're on a continuous BTKI and you relapse and you progress on the continuous BTKI, that drug is gone forever. You know, if you develop resistance to ibrutinib or acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib, you will be resistant to all the first and second generation drugs. You have just lost a treatment for your patient's CLL. If you relapse after venetoclax obinutuzumab, you can in general be retreated and get another response. So you haven't actually lost that treatment. So although the PFS one may be different, I think the bigger question in the long term is how long can you give a drug for before you have to lose a drug, before you lose either BTKI or BCL2 and have to move to the next one. So that's where I think long-term data for CLL17 will come in.
So, and I'm curious too, in terms of the issue of rechallenge with venetoclax, how long after, first of all, typically, how long is it after being treated with, say, obinutuzumab venetoclax up front that you would see, where do you see the relapses occurring, and how do you determine whether to rechallenge or go into something else?
So depending on your prognostic subgroup, you typically should get 4 to 7 years. So somewhere between 4 to 7 years of progression-free survival after VEN plus OBIN. So most authorities around the world would say that if you relapse within 2 years at the end of completing venetoclax-based therapy, there's probably no point in rechallenging. The patient is at least partially resistant to venetoclax. And that 2-year cut point is not driven by data. It's more of a general consensus amongst experts. It's a general gut feel that if you relapse within 2 years of venetoclax, it's probably time to move on. There's pretty good data, though, to suggest both in real world and in follow-up the clinical trial that for patients who relapse beyond 2 years, that they do respond to another challenge of venetoclax. What we don't know is how long that response is going to last for, because we need more follow-up. Chances are they will not respond as long the second time compared to the third time. To the first time, you know, with most of our treatment for any diseases, we'll roughly, you know, you roughly lose about 50% of PFS each time you challenge. But, you know, if you got 5 years the first time and you get 3 years the second time, that's 8 years total duration before you have to, you know, lose the venetoclax, you know, effectiveness. So that's still pretty good.
So I think you made a pretty persuasive argument for time-limited therapy, whether that's going to be with venetoclax and obinutuzumab or with BTK. I'm wondering how you would indirectly compare zanubrutinib to acalabrutinib, both in terms of safety, but particularly in terms of efficacy, and whether, again, putting aside del-17P for a second, you see any potential advantage one way or the other. You know, with Zanu, you reported a benefit with PFS. I'm curious whether you think that's something that is a consideration. Do you have any preference?
Sure. So I think the first thing to say is that they're both really good options, okay? So that's, we're choosing between, we're talking about very fine considerations and differences between two very good options. The second thing is to note is that there has been no head-to-head comparison between Acala and Xandu. So everything else that we're talking about is going to be inferred from the data out there. Now, in that context, there's been two head-to-head studies between Xandu and ibrutinib and Acala versus ibrutinib, both in relapse CLL and both head-to-head. For the Acala combination comparison, it was equivalent to ibrutinib in terms of progression-free survival. For the zanubrutinib comparison, it was superior to ibrutinib in terms of progression-free survival, especially in 17p, but across both groups, with or without, it's superior. And on that basis, you know, I can tell you that the data supports zanubrutinib as being superior than ibrutinib, and the data supports Acala as being equivalent to ibrutinib, but I don't think I can confidently say that Xandu is better than acalabrutinib because it has not been direct compared head-to-head, and you have to draw your own inference. Then the next question is, why do we think zanubrutinib may be better than acalabrutinib? And to that, I think you have to get really nerdy and think about the pharmacokinetics of BDKI. So zanubrutinib actually has really high drug levels. So the drug levels are actually somewhere between 6 to 10 times higher than that of ibrutinib because it gets absorbed so well. And in fact, all of these drugs inhibit BDK in both a reversible and an irreversible manner. And what the BDK mutation does is it converts the binding from irreversible to reversible. And Xandu's drug levels are actually so high that it actually maintains both reversible and irreversible bind inhibition of BDK across the 24-hour period. The same cannot be said of Acala and ibrutinib. Both those drugs have got actually really low drug levels and really rely on the irreversible mechanism of inhibition of BDKI. So in simplistic terms, Xandu just got much higher drug levels than the other two. And one can speculate maybe that's why, you know, it's superior to ibrutinib in the randomized studies. Then the next question is, do you pay a price for the high drug levels? Are there worse side effects with Xandu compared to Acala? And both those drugs are safer than ibrutinib in terms of atrial fibrillation. And in fact, if you look at the cardiac arrhythmia rates, zanubrutinib and acalabrutinib are both very similar, if not maybe a little bit lower and a little bit better for zanubrutinib. But there is a difference in the hypertension signal in that for the Acala comparison, there was less patients getting hypertension on acalabrutinib, whereas for the zanubrutinib combination, it was identical to ibrutinib. So Acala may be advantage to in terms of reduced hypertension rates. Zanubrutinib, a advantage in terms of pharmacokinetics, high drug levels, and a superior outcome compared to ibrutinib.
So getting down to clinic, assuming equal access to both, how do you decide between the two? Does it matter where they have a history of hypertension? Do they have a history of headache? Anything that's what pushes you one way or the other, or is it equal option in your mind?
I use zanubrutinib just because of familiarity. This is a drug that I've used for a very long time since phase one. So that's what I tend to prescribe. But to someone who is very used to and comfortable with acalabrutinib, I think that's still a very good option. As you pointed out, a few subtleties. So someone who's got, you know, really bad headaches and migraines, acalabrutinib may be less preferred. Having said that, those patients can be managed on acalabrutinib. The headache tends to be transient. Equally, hypertension, we've got also good drugs against hypertension. It's more about paying attention to the blood pressure and controlling it. And I don't see someone with hypertension as being a deal breaker for either of the two drugs.
So let's talk about the high-risk patients, L17P. We saw some more data at ASH focusing on that. What's the bottom line in terms of what we know, particularly in terms of continuous BTK versus time-limited therapy and choice of agents?
Yep. So for the 17P population, these patients are a lot better these days than chemotherapy, but I would still worry a lot about these patients because they do develop resistance faster. They probably do not respond quite as well to venetoclax compared to wild-type patients. So I think it's really important to choose the best BDK inhibitor. So in this population, at least in my practice, if I am going to use a BDKI, I will use Xandu just because the largest, the best dollars behind Xanu, and the drug levels are the highest behind Xanu. The next question is continuous versus short duration therapy. And the general doctrine is that these patients do better on continuous BTKI compared to the fixed duration regimen, which is true. And you can see that borne out in CL17, where especially for venetoclax or bendamustine, they do less well when they're 17p deleted compared to patients who are wild type. But once again, I think there is a caveat, and this is where the discussion with the patient comes in. If I have a deletion 17p patient who is 40 years old, has a family, wants to travel a lot, and is a doc, I really feel strong about fixed duration therapy. Again, I don't want BDKI because I'm on any other drugs. I really want this. I'm not going to say no to that patient. I'm going to say, look, you understand that if I give you vanobin, that you're going to get a 4-year progression-free survival compared to 7 years, it'd be shorter. But, you know, you might need to be retreated. But the thing is that you're not resistant. You can be rechallenged. So although the headline PFS is different between BDKI and vanobin, we do know that you can be rechallenged with vanobin. So for those patients who feel strongly about fixed duration therapy, I actually don't think giving a fixed duration therapy for 17P is wrong, provided that they understand that they're going to get a shorter progression-free survival of approximately 4 years compared to patients without those high risk features, and they may need to be retreated earlier. And there's actually emerging data that probably the BDK-containing doublets actually do slightly better for this deletion 17P compared to vanobin. So maybe acalavan would do better, maybe xanovan would do better, and certainly we saw for xanu somro that the 17P response rates are very high.
So I'm going to move on in a second, finish out talking about relapse disease, but just a couple more questions as it relates to upfront therapy. First of all, can you just briefly summarize what you presented there in terms of the STAIR study? Really yep. Interesting trial. A lot of times when I hear the you all in CLL talking, I think about prostate cancer because they had a trial a couple years ago looking at time-limited endocrine therapy that you know, now they're using all the time. But anyhow, what did the STAIR study look at, demonstrate, and what do you think it means in terms of clinical practice, particularly in terms of patients who are having problems on BTK inhibitors?
Yeah, so, you know, when we first started using BDKI, the common perception is that it's continuous. You start on a drug, you're stuck on it, there's no stopping it until they progress. And in fact, from the ECOG 1912, which is the comparison between ibrutinib and FCR, there was an interesting piece of data in that patients who actually came off ibrutinib because of side effects, they were actually 2 years before those patients needed to be retreated. And that caught everyone's eyes and thought, oh, wow. So if you actually have been treated with BDKI for a while, not in the first 12 months, but you've been treated with BDKI for a while and you're in a pretty good response, that maybe coming off the drug is not a disaster. You know, maybe people do not relapse straight away. And I think that piece of information is what the STAIR study really confirms, right? It says that, okay, if we get treated with acala for 18 months, you're in a pretty good response, and we stop it, what will happen? And what will happen is that you will relapse, but at a median of 1 year later, so if the patient gets a 1 year time off drug, off side effects, and then if you restart the drug, your overall survival is identical. So you haven't really lost anything except for that, you know, and you get the 1 year of drug holiday. So that really proves in a randomized fashion what we saw before, that in someone who is in a pretty good response, they can, especially for side effects, they can potentially stop the drug and it takes them a little while before they progress and you get the opportunity for a drug holiday. I think an important consideration is the 18-month mark optimal. And it may still be that the 18-month mark is a little bit early. And maybe if they get to the 2 year, 2.5 year mark before you give them a drug cessation, maybe they'll get an even longer time before they ultimately relapse because they're more deeply treated. So I think that's an interesting question for the practice. So I think what, you know, in my clinical practice, I definitely would not stop someone before 12 months. I would try and switch BDKI. Between, let's say, 12 months to 24 months, if someone has got pretty unmanageable side effects and their CLL seems to be in pretty good control, the lymph glands are gone, the white cells are low, I would be comfortable based on the data to give them a drug holiday. But I think ideally, if you're going to take someone off probably more like 24 months or longer, before you take them off, and you might even get a longer time before you have to be retreated.
It kind of looked like a pretty big difference there in terms of IGVH status. Clinically, would you take that into account?
I would, and because we do know that patients who are IGVH mutated are the ones who do relapse with slower kinetics, so the ones that I would maybe stop a bit earlier rather than later. That is dependent on your ability to do IGVH sequencing, right? So I do that because I'm in a research center, all my patients have IGVH results known, but that may not be available for patients in community practice.
Let's talk a little bit about pirtobrutinib. We saw two big phase 3 trials presented at the ASH meeting. Could you kind of summarize what they reported, what you think it means? And also, whether you see any evidence at this point, again, you were talking about your thoughts in terms of zanubrutinib maybe having more efficacy than acala and why, whether you think you see hints of that with pirtobrutinib of a greater efficacy, and if so, what the mechanism might be. But let's just start out with the two trials.
Yeah. So there are two trials. There's a head-to-head study between pirtobrutinib and ibrutinib, including both frontline and relapse patients. And there's a second trial comparing pirtobrutinib and bendamustine rituximab in the front line. So let's start with the second trial. So pirtobrutinib versus BR, no surprise to anyone that the BTKI is better. And it does look reasonably favorable in terms of pirtobrutinib, the results. What you expect for maybe even a little bit better than historic, for what you expect for ibrutinib or zanu or acala, in the same range or slightly better. So pirtobrutinib is certainly an effective drug. The main advantage of pirtobrutinib is that it's got very few side effects. So probably has the least side effects of the BTKI. And we all know that frontline patients are terrible at compliance. You know, I still remember from my CML days where if you treat someone with imatinib in second line and beyond, they never stop the drug because they know what interferon is like. But if you treat someone with imatinib in the frontline for CML, their compliance is terrible. And the same thing in CLL. So I think pirtobrutinib has an advantage is that it's got so few side effects. So in the front line, very few patients are going to stop pirtobrutinib. Now, the second comparison is pirtobrutinib versus ibrutinib. And I think that's the big question, right? Is pirtobrutinib better than ibrutinib? And the signals are mixed. So the according to the investigators assessed responses, pirtobrutinib may be better than ibrutinib. But with the central reveal responses, it looks identical. And then if you dissect out between first-line treatment and relapse refractory patients, it looks like the improvement potentially is only in the first-line patients. So the way I'm interpreting this data is I think it's all about compliance. We all know that ibrutinib has side effects and pirtobrutinib doesn't have any. And I'm thinking that probably patients on pirtobrutinib are more likely to stay on drug than ibrutinib, and that might be where some of the advantage to pirtobrutinib comes from. Especially, as you can see, there's advantage, especially in the front line. We need more data to tell. They said that at least on a global trial level, combining both relapse and refractory and frontline patients, that the cessation rates are similar. I'll be really surprised in the frontline setting if pirtobrutinib is not better in terms of compliance than ibrutinib when they eventually release the data. From my mechanism point of view, I don't see why pirtobrutinib should be better than covalent BTKI. Is a reversible binding. It relies on a long half-life to achieve the same thing as a covalent BTKI. And although it's somewhat immune to the cysteine-481 mutation, it's susceptible to a whole range of other mutations, which we know we see in pirtobrutinib when they relapse. So it's not like the degraders, which is immune to most of the mutations. It's actually one that is still susceptible to the mutations. So I don't see a reason from a mechanism point of view, why pirtobrutinib should be better.
I thought it was interesting that they saw a PFS advantage, I think it was versus ibrutinib, I think, and the investigators with not central review. What would be an example, not necessarily from this trial, but in general, when do you see investigators having different responses or efficacy outcomes than central? What's the reason?
So that's a really good question. So the most marked example of that, to my knowledge, is actually the RESONATE study. So this is a study comparing ibrutinib to ofatumumab back almost a decade ago, where the central reveal showed actually pretty terrible outcomes for ibrutinib in terms of PFS, but the investigators showed really good outcomes. And the reason why was because of scans. So a lot of patients in that study on the ibrutinib arm had a drug hold for side effect and then had a CT scan done at the time of drug hold. And obviously, the lymph glands got bigger. The central committee said progression. The investigator on the ground managed the side effect, restarted the drug, and the patient did well, and the investigator never called it the PFS. And I think a similar thing is happening here. I suspect that the central committee is blinded to what the patient's going through. I suspect that there might be some minor progressions on CT scan due to drug hold or other reasons that were called by the central committee, but the investigator on the ground just basically adjusted the dose, managed the side effects, and kept it going and never called it a progression.
Really interesting. You mentioned the tolerability profile of pirtobrutinib. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it looked like AFib was the same as BR. Does that mean like it does not have an increased risk of AFib in your mind?
No, I think AFib is a BTK class side effect. Certainly, pirto has a very low risk of AFib. If you look at the Sequoia study comparing Zanu and BR, the AFib rates are also very similar between the two arms, with prolonged follow-up maybe a touch higher numerically for Zanu compared to BR. But I think it just shows that with the modern BTKIs, the second and third generations, that we're getting such low AFib rates that it's very hard to show a difference compared to chemotherapy.
What about bleeding with pirtobrutinib?
So it probably is, once again, it's still a problem. So I would not, let's say, operate on a patient on pirtobrutinib without stopping the drug, because once again, bleeding is a BTK class side effect. Worse for ibrutinib compared to the other drugs, but is present across everything. And the reason we know that is because if we look at BTK deficient boys, so these are people born without BTK, right? Genetic knockout BTK. Those patients actually have a platelet defect. They actually have a defect in the collagen receptor response in the platelet count. So if you knock out BTK, you will cause a bleeding deficit. The reason why ibrutinib is worse than everything on earth is because ibrutinib not only knocks out BTK, it knocks out a whole bunch of other things, which makes the platelet dysfunction even worse.
So let's talk about the patient who's double refractory. First of all, maybe you can kind of paint a picture of how often you see it and kind of what a typical double refractory situation looks like, and particularly how you think it through, particularly in the younger versus older patient with comorbidities.
So to start with, it's actually still a pretty uncommon scenario. So double refractory, we mean by someone who has progressed on a covalent BTKI and someone who has resistance to venetoclax, either a progression on venetoclax or relapse shortly after completing venetoclax. And it's actually still pretty uncommon. Even in my population, were patients who had really early access to these drugs, 10, 12 years ago from clinical trial. And the reason why it's uncommon is because these patients do so well. You get 7 years on the first drug, and you get another 5 years on the second drug before you get your double refractory stage. And so the patients do come through, but they're pretty uncommon. What do they look like? Well, they tend to be the patients who have got the 17p, who's got the more complex karyotypes, who may have come from a historic era where they got chemotherapy as their first line treatment. And these are patients who are actually pretty sick, right? So you've lost the covalent BTKI and you've lost the BCL2. And probably standard of treatment these days is pirtobrutinib for these patients. Although we know that pirto is not a permanent solution. We're looking at maybe a 12-month progression-free survival before you have to move to something else, which would probably be the degraders. And these are patients that I would strongly consider liso-cel for, because we know that once you get the double refractory stage, that you'd be looking at next line therapies having fairly short progression-free survivals. And we do know that for you to proceed to CAR T cells, you want to be in the best response category possible. So you don't want to wait till you run out of all the options and have no way to debulk your patients before CAR T cells.
And I wanted to ask you about CAR T and liso-cel. It kind of reminds me, at least in my own naive mind, it kind of reminds me of what I kind of had heard initially about CAR T with follicular lymphoma, where initially I kind of got like the feeling it wasn't very effective. And then as you start seeing more data, I'm like, oh, that looks pretty good. And again, with liso-cel, I wasn't so sure, but the data that came out at ASH was very interesting in that regard. Can you kind of talk a little bit about what your vision was in terms of efficacy before ASH, and then talk a little bit about the ASH presentation? Also, can you comment on the issue of cytokine release syndrome in these patients?
Sure. I might just go with the last one first. So cytokine release is a problem for CLL patients relative to other histologies. Whether you use CAR T cells or bispecific, CLL patients probably have heavier tumor burden in terms of overall number of tumor, and they do get more CRS. For the bispecifics, they probably need an extra step up. But CRS can be managed, right? You know, I can manage CRS in the clinic. What I can't manage is I can't manage resistant cancer. That's something I can't deal with. Let's head back to CAR T cells. Now, people forget that, in fact, the first disease to be cured by CAR T cell is actually CLL. You know, this is a New England paper from David Porter and company back in the, you know, the early 2010s type range, where we had three patients, heavily advanced CLL, got CAR T cells, were cured forever of the disease. And then, of course, CAR T cells moved on to other diseases since then. And when I look at the last of cell data, I actually think it's pretty terrible. I think the response rates are very poor. And I think that, you know, the responses are infrequent. But it did not surprise me. In fact, you know, patients who get onto CAR T cells in the transient type era were really last line patients. These patients, if anything, you should be surprised that CAR T cells work for these patients. They've been through chemotherapy, they've had fludarabine, they've had every targeted treatment possible. They do not have a single T cell to their name. And yet we're getting these really diseased, dysfunctional T cells and trying to make CAR T cells out from these patients. And we're trying to treat them when they've got really poorly controlled disease. And we're surprised that the patients don't respond. You know, when you put poor quality CAR T cell into a patient with a lot of disease on board, you're going to get poor outcomes. So we've always thought that these patients probably need to be treated at an earlier line when they're not so heavily exposed. And hopefully we now have a cohort of patients who've never seen fludarabine. And so the T cell numbers are better. And they should be treated with good disease control. We see in the real world data that if you have bulky lymph nodes, that you're not going to do as well because you've got poor disease control. That's not new. So I think the real world data is reassuring that now that it's in the real world, we've got patients who are relatively fitter, we've got investigators who are understanding more how to use CAR T cells, that we need to use it in healthier patients before they run out of all the other options. We treat them at a time when the disease is under good control with at least, you know, at least one biological drug. We continue the drug during the CAR T cell process so that they don't get this sort of paradoxical rebound when we stop the drug before the CAR T cells, then we get better outcomes. And these are the results that I think should have always happened with CLL. It's just that the clinical trial, unfortunately, was done in a time where those patients, you know, were not enrolled.
So it also looked like they did better if they got ibrutinib.
Yep. So there are probably two theories to that. So the first theory is that ibrutinib, or in fact, any BTKI, probably improves the T cell quality at the time of apheresis. So you're getting better quality T cells to make CAR T cells. And the second thing is it probably reflects that these patients actually had disease control coming into CAR. We were able to control the disease with either ibrutinib or BTKI before we CAR them, and we're not doing CAR in the context of someone who's got rampant uncontrolled disease.
So one final question. If you and your colleagues, let's say 2 or 3 years from now, want to sit down and do another review article on upfront treatment of CLL, just like this year when you did it, and then you had all this great stuff come out at ASH, but just curious what your prediction is in terms of where you think we'll be 2 or 3 years. Also, you mentioned BTK degraders. You think in 2 or 3 years they'll be online and where they're going to fit in, but would you like to sort of paint a picture of your vision for CLL 2, 3 years from now? Or maybe five, I don't know.
I actually think that there's going to be two types of patients. There are patients who got started on a continuous BTK pathway who will end up on a sort of continuous BTK pathway. So they go from a covalent to a non-covalent to a degrader and then migrate to other things. And then I think there'll be a fresh new cohort of patients who got time-limited duration therapy, who will get either venlafaxine or ven-BTKI, who then would get 5 years and then be retreated with BTKI plus VAN. So it's the same combination or different combination again, and we'll get another, you know, 5 years or 3 years after that. And, you know, if you think about the MRD clearance rate of someone like Zanusomro, right? You know, we've got 90% MRD clearance rate. Hypothetically, these patients can be in remission for 7, 8 years with the first treatment, and then another 4 years after that. And that's 12 years of total duration with two lots of fixed oral therapy in the 80-year-old. By the time they relapse for the third time and require treatment, then in the mid-90s. So maybe these are, you know, we're moving into an age where doublet therapy to be repeated will be the only treatment that these patients will ever see in their life, and they'll never need to go down the path of having pirtobrutinib or degraders.
Also, just kind of curious whether you think pirtobrutinib is going to move into time-limited therapy. Your previous institution, MD Anderson, is all excited about pirtobrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab. Do you think that pirtobrutinib is going to end up being the BTKI in time-limited therapy?
I think pirtobrutinib is a great choice for time-limited therapy because of its side effect profile. I suspect that PVO will not take off in popularity because of obinutuzumab, but PV might. My expectation, given having seen the other drugs, though, is that I think PV is once again going to hit a wall in terms of MRD clearance. I don't think it'll be that high without obinutuzumab. No data, but this is my general feeling. And I suspect that probably, you know, someone like pirtobrutinib or zanusomrol or acalazomrol will be the way forward.
Interesting. Do you see BTK degraders ended up in first line?
I do not, actually, at least not as a time-limited duration therapy, because the main advantage of BTK degraders is reduced resistance and mutations. But at the moment, we don't see resistance mutations with time-limited duration therapy. Maybe they will change with time, but at current follow-up, you get fixed duration therapy and you relapse, you do not have resistant mutations. So the advantage of degraders are already gone from that in terms of that setting.
All right, Khan, thank you so much. I learned a lot, as I always do every time I talk to you. I really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you very much for the interest.
Subsequent to the recording of this program, the FDA approved acalabrutinib with venetoclax for chronic lymphocytic leukemia on the basis of data from the Phase 3 AMPLIFY trial. This concludes our program. Conflict of interest statements for the faculty can be found in the program notes. The use of agents and treatments that are not approved may be discussed, so check out the package inserts for more. Special thanks to Professor Tam, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.